Mary, you did that well. All right, the next part's the introduction to the speaker. That's where I get to stand up here and I tell you all these little witty things that we did and, you know, experiences that we had and all that kind of wonderful stuff. Well, Bobby got a late flight. And it was later. And we got here late and we had very little chance to interact yesterday evening. So I told him today, I said, well, Bobby, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do one of the things that I do best. I'll just lie. You know, I'll make some stuff up. You know, that's what I'm good at. He said, well, tell him the part about where we were licking the candles and having a prayer meeting. I don't quite understand all of that. But, you know, that's what the man said, you know. And this was Brownie Bates before mine, so I'm kind of listening, you know. I did, however, have an opportunity to recently to listen to Bobby's tape, and he's got a wonderful message, an absolute wonderful message, and that's what he's here to share with us. So if you would, help me welcome Bobby Coyle.
It was lighting candles, not licking. Something got lost. Slight accent, something got lost in the translation. My name's Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to come here. I am from Philadelphia and not Mississippi. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and it's great to be here. I was in Memphis yesterday at the airport, and I looked up at the screen there for Biloxi. It said 70 degrees in Philadelphia. I watched CNN this morning. We're in the midst of a snowstorm. It's a small one. They're only going to get about 8 inches of snow today. So, but I'm definitely glad to be here, you know, and it's been a while since I've been here. I was back here in the 70s. I spent some time over Keesler, and Biloxi's changed a little bit, you know. I didn't go down Veterans Avenue. I don't even know if them clubs are still there or not, but it definitely changed a lot. So, but it's good to be here, and what I will do, Chapter 5 tells me what I'm supposed to do. I will tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar, very ethnic neighborhood. I got 8 brothers and sisters. We had no booze at all in the house. My father did not drink, and my mother could not drink. My mother suffered from a history of mental illness and abuse for prescription medication, so we had no booze at all in the house. My grandparents lived around the corner from us, and they had a bar in their basement, and that's where all the family functions were held, you know, the christenings, the parties, and things like that. And that's where I had my very first drink. And I didn't get drunk the very first time I drank. Well, what happened, I was just a kid, but what I remember, it was the feeling that came with that, you know. And I was running around the bar, I was polishing off the half empties or the half fulls, you know, depends on perception. And I was polishing these off, and my uncles were looking at me, and my uncle said, hey, look at him, look at Bobby. And that's what I loved. I craved the attention. I never felt a part of. And that's pretty tough to do when you got 11 people living in a small 3-bedroom row home, but I never felt a part of. And that would be true even into early recovery. But I love the attention that came with that. And like I said, I didn't get drunk, but what I remember was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies. And I remember we were on the County Mac Stadium with my father and the old school board in right center field. My drinking really took off in high school. Most, you know, a lot of the kids in the neighborhood, they went to the local diocese in high school. But my parents had sent me to a private Jesuit high school. And most of the kids that went to this school were from affluent families from the suburbs. It was me and a couple other dirtballs in the neighborhood. We went there. And right away, I felt kind of out of place because, you know, we used to walk to school, so we had a reputation because the school was in a pretty rough area. And these kids, they were getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, and me and the guys in the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. And I knew that was wrong, but you know what? I would do things, again, all through my drinking, I would do things in my gut that I knew was wrong, but I did it anyway because you came to expect it. I had a lot of nicknames, and one of those nicknames was Crazy Coyle. And I would do things, again, like to entertain you, but again, the need for me to fit in outweighed anything else, you know? So I would do things against my, you know, my training, my upbringing, my values, convictions. They all went out the window. So I'm at the prep, and we're there about 2 weeks in September. You know, school just starts its football season. There was an away game. We rented a bus. There was alcohol. There was fighting. There was police. All types of insanity. And so the following school day, we had to line up and see the disciplinarian. And he had about 10 of us lined up. But it was me and another guy from my neighborhood. We were the only freshmen. Everyone else was upperclassmen. And he came right up to us. He said, "What's with you guys? You guys here like 2 weeks and you're getting this jackpot already." I just shrugged my shoulders. I said, "You know, Father, just one of them things, you know." And what that was, like, it didn't take me long to size up situations. And I saw who was about what, and that's who I decided to hang out with. I didn't hang out with the brainiacs, the smart kids. I didn't hang out with the athletes. I hung out with the guys who wanted to get loaded, wanted to act up. That's who I hung out with, you know. And so, you know, I just loved all the attention, all the insanity went with that. And, you know, my sophomore year at the prep, the school where I was on 18th Street. And four blocks away was the subway. And a lot of these kids, it was their first introduction to the inner city. So after school, they would take the trolley four blocks to catch the subway because they were scared to walk out the street. Well, three blocks away on the corner of 15th and Girard, there was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. When I was a sophomore, I was a regular at the Ebony. And I went there for a couple of different reasons. They had cold beer, you know, they had some dancers. But again, this reputation, I guess I was a legend in my own mind. This reputation, me and the guys in the neighborhood had, so we would stroll out to Rod Avenue and sit in the Ebony. Now I'm what? I'm 16, I look like I'm 12. I got one of these blazers on, you know, the guys from the neighborhood, you could tell from by the name of the bar, like I wasn't a local, you know, but they served me anyway. I'm sitting here, I'm just drinking beer, and these guys, you know, the locals, they just thought we were nuts anyway, and that's what I loved. I loved the attention. I can now tell you, every time I strolled out to Rod Avenue and sat in the Ebony, I was terrified. But I couldn't let anybody know that, you know. Again, the need to be accepted outweighed anything else. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education. And it kind of ticked my parents off because we didn't have much growing up. And they made a lot of sacrifices to send me there. So I know I couldn't stay home. There'd be hell to catch. So my options were limited, you know. Like I couldn't get my own spot. Like, you know, I had no money. I had no skills. I had nothing. So what I did, the only thing left, I enlisted in the service. And back then, that really wasn't bright news because nobody else was going. People were going north, but no one was going. But I enlisted, and I wound up getting sent overseas, and I spent 13 months overseas, and that's when my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances. I never even smoked pot. And there were a lot of guys from my neighborhood, good friends of mine, who had gone over and got whacked on certain things. So I had a fear of other substances. So I didn't mess around with that. But by this time, I definitely had a heavy drinking problem. I was there a couple months and several good friends of mine got killed, and I didn't know how to handle that. Because in my neighborhood and in my house, we never talked about nothing. It was all surface stuff, you know. And growing up in my house, everything stayed inside you, and everything stayed within the walls of the house. So once you moved out, whether you got married or went to school, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. That's just the way it was. So, you know, this kind of bothered me, and I didn't know how to talk to people about that, but I knew that alcohol numbed the pain. And that's what I did. You know, I just numbed myself with booze. And I didn't distinguish myself, but I didn't do badly either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by, and I was satisfied with that because I didn't want to draw any attention to myself. I just wanted to skate by, do my deal, no big thing. My tour was up. I came home. I wound up taking a couple civil service examinations, and then I enrolled in school. I went to St. Joe's College, which is like the feeder school. That was a Jesuit university hooked up with the high school I went to. I'm in school, you know, and I'm not doing much there either. Again, not distinguishing myself, but not doing badly either. Just like under the radar, so I don't draw any attention to myself, giving them the bare minimum effort required to get by. And I remember it was May, it was towards the end of the semester, and the Phillies were playing one of those business name specials, one of those weekday afternoon games, and the guys from my neighborhood had called me up the night before. They said, "Bobby, the Phillies are playing at 12 o'clock tomorrow. You want to go down and see them?" I said, "Sure, I'll go down." So I cut class, I went down to the game, me and four other guys, and by this time the Phillies had moved, they're playing at Vet Stadium. I'm sitting up at the 700 level drinking that cheap watered down beer. And this was a very unusually warm day, and the sun's beating down on me, I'm getting trashed. And I said, turned to one of the guys I was with, I said, "You know what?" I said, "I'm going to run down the field and meet one of the players." And they said, "That's okay, Bobby." And they kind of shrugged me off, because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I was like, "I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I did that." I didn't do nothing, I drank, that's right. Then I told stories and drank, that's it. So they kind of shrugged me off. So I worked my way down to the old picnic area, and I jumped over the fence, I ran out in right field, and the Phillies were playing San Diego Padres. And Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. And I went out and I shook his hand, I said, "Hi Dave, how you doing?" And he looked at me and he said, "Brother," he said, "what are you doing out here?" And from behind him, because he's a pretty big dude, I saw the guards coming. I said, "Dave, I got to go now." So I started running towards the infield. I went to slide into second base. And as I was going towards the infield, there was more guards coming from the third base side. And if I knew if I slid into the base, I'd get caught. So I turned around, I start going towards first base, and I was going to give myself up to the guard. And I'm probably as close as Jason and I are to the guard as Jason and I are right now. And I'm about to give myself up, and I beat the guy, and I ran out in the outfield. Now I'm running around like a lunatic. It seems like 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to like 2 or 3. And you know, but I'm drunk, I'm out of breath, it's hot, I got nowhere to go. I mean, it's like 12-foot high walls in the outfield. But you know, the stadium's going nuts. They put up on the scoreboard, they put Mr. Excitement. You know? I finally stopped. I'm in right field. I'm waiting for them to come pick me up. They got me. They was taking me off the field. I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. It was incredible. Chuck McGraw was in the bullpen. He gave me the thumbs up, like, later on. Yeah. I knew I was going to get it beaten from the guards because I made them look stupid. That was okay. They could have beat on me all day long because I had my four friends from the neighborhood. They were witnesses. See, if they weren't there, I'd go back to the neighborhood and tell that story, no one would believe me. But I now knew I had four witnesses. I'd be a legend in the neighborhood for a long time. So as they was taking me off the field, I was about to get my beating, just then a Philadelphia police lieutenant came up. He said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Are you drunk? Are you high?" I said, "No, I'm just happy. Just happy to be here." He said, "Well, you better get your happy ass out of that stadium." So not only did he save me from a beating, but most importantly, he saved me from getting arrested. And that was kind of important because in civil service exams I took, like one of them panned out. And a couple weeks later, I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They was hiring anybody back then. It was nuts. It was crazy. There was 8,500 of us. 8,500 cops, and our mayor was a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. He was a former cop himself, and we did whatever the hell we wanted to do. I wasn't even old enough to drink. The drinking age in Pennsylvania is 21. Where I lived in Philadelphia, Jersey was right across the river. I could be in Jersey quicker than I could be other parts of Philadelphia. So I used to go over to Jersey and drink because the age at that time was 18. So, but once I got on the job, I can go wherever the hell I want to go, you know. And I spent my first 10 years in a pretty rough area in North Philadelphia. And I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of the tour, I would go out with guys in my squad, and I'd go out and pound them drinking. And I saw things from the job that bothered me, but I couldn't tell my coworkers that because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys, to the point where I even engaged in behaviors that I was uncomfortable with, that I knew it was wrong, but I did it anyway because the need to be accepted outweighed anything else, you know? And it just got ugly quickly, you know? You know, my job was definitely a big enabler. I got in trouble a couple of times, but, you know, I just, you know, show my ID, and they let me go and be on my way. It was nuts. And you know what? The handwriting was on the wall early, you know. I remember I had a supervisor who pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, kid? You're smart, and you're going to go places. That booze is going to mess you up. One ear and out the other, you know." I had an uncle on my job. And in my family, you know, that's what, like, a lot of, you know, the men did. You know, they were either, you know, cops or, you know, couple priests and, you know, a couple crooks and in some cases all three. But it was just, you know, so I had this uncle in the job. He was a supervisor and he pulled me off. I had a family function. He said, "Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You better slow down." In one ear and out the other. I got sober a few years later. I ran into my uncle and I ran into that supervisor on two separate occasions in AA meetings. And I realized that at that point they were trying to 12-step me. And I remember talking to my uncle. I said, "Jimmy," I said, "how come you didn't tell me?" He said, "I told you." He said, "You just weren't ready yet." He just smiled, you know. And that's what's true, you know. Every drink and all the behaviors that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I made my first meeting in 1979. I don't tell people I went out because I really never came in. But I'll tell you what had happened. I showed up at work one day. We had one of my coworkers was drunk, and we had a counseling unit. And part of our counseling unit, they had an AA group there. And I pulled into work, and the supervisor said, "Drive this guy up to the unit." I said, "Okay." And I'm coming down the driveway, and they had this little house in the park. And I'm coming down the driveway, and I pulled up, and there's this guy sitting on the porch. His name was Eddie N. And I said, "Eddie, I'm here to drop this guy off. I'll be back at 4 o'clock to pick him up." He looked me dead in the eye. He said, "Kid, do you want to come in?" I said, "No, I don't." I was insulted that he even asked me. I knew what AA was. Alcoholics, there was some poor people I was dealing with day in, day out, you know. These married guys, your older guys, your guys with the three heads, you know, they were alcoholics. I was a beer drinker. There was no way that I had a problem drinking. You know, the only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Patty's Day, or like New Year's Day, or like payday. But I was a broker. And there was no way that you could be an alcoholic drinking beer. So, and I said, no, he was insulted that he hears me. You know, I got sober a few years later, and Eddie was one of the first guys I saw. And as soon as I came in, his eyes lit up, and he just smiled. He said, it's okay, you finally came around. And again, it was just goes to show you that every drink was necessary. I was 24, and I wound up shooting and killing a 15-year-old kid in the line of work. And it was really a terrible situation. I couldn't really avoid it. A lot of people offered help, and I just rejected everything. And I used it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle. And that's what I did for the next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27. And then it just got ugly, you know. And I was, you know, I had a pretty successful career, and this was just terrible. And my drinking took me to a lot of my nevers, and I wound up getting promoted and transferred in this unit. And one night I'm drinking, my judgment was impaired, and I was in a position where I thought I needed to do other things, and that's what I did. And so I got involved in other substances. And my drug history is very short. It only lasted 17 months, but it caused me enough pain and a lot of other turmoil to come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, and I think out of our fifth tradition, that's really all I need to talk about that stuff. You know, my drinking took me everywhere, you know. I was sitting home from work one day and I saw an ad in the paper. I need to back up. You know that story I ran on the field, you know? I tell that story for a couple of reasons. One, it's true. It really is. It's not a story. But like Patty shared this morning, I was a major, major blackout drinker. It was one of the few stories I remember. I would show up the next day and the guys in the corner would say, yo, you know, and they would report back to me and they said, man, you should have seen me last night. And they would tell stories and I would laugh about it and I would tell the stories later. I was a major blackout drinker from my early drinking. I blacked out drinking beer, you know, before I moved to liquor. So, and another reason I tell that story, it's the only funny story I got. You know, I wasn't a funny dude, you know. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't a lover. I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking fool and down the violent drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. You know, I used and abused every person I came in contact with. So that's the way that went. You know, I was sitting home from work one day and there's an ad in the paper. It said alcohol problems, drug problems, depression, marital problems, thoughts of suicide. I'm looking at it. I'm 4 out of 5. I'm single. And I'm sure if I was married, I'd been batting 1,000. And I'm taking a look at the ad and, you know, they talk about the moment of clarity or sanity. As soon as it came, it quickly left. But something made me cut that ad out and I stuck it in my wallet and I continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. I'm sitting in this bar. And we have a squad party. And one of the guys I was with, he said, for some reason he needs to go. He said, I'm going home. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a ride home. I'm not as drunk as you are. And he thought that was a pretty good idea. So I'm in my car, I'm riding up the street. And a couple blocks ahead of me, there, I see a kid on a bike. And I decided that I was going to show off my driving skills in front of my coworker. I was always a show off. I was always an arrogant guy. I had a lot of success in my career. I got a lot of publicity, and just in case you missed the article, I just happened to have a couple on me. I would show it to you. I was just really arrogant, you know. So I seen this kid, and I decided I was going to play chicken with this kid. And unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction. I ran this kid over. As he lied bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car, and my nightstick was going to beat this kid because I thought he was milking me for an insurance claim. The guy was with prevented me from doing that. I pulled this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled his crumpled bicycle from underneath my car and threw that off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar. I made a remark. I scored 10 points, and I continued on drinking. When I came through the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep. I really was a nasty person. You know, towards the end of my drinking, I couldn't even get people to hang out with me anymore. People would say, you make up all types of stories, and I would even have some people say, now I'm broke. I said, that's all right, I got money. And then he would come up with another excuse. I said, no thanks, Bobby. And that's pretty bad. We can't even buy people anymore, you know. So I didn't know what to do. So I got a bottle of liquor, a case of beer, and some other substances, and I checked in a hotel with the intention to consume all this stuff to build up the courage and my life. And 3 days later, they're knocking on the hotel to kick me out of the hotel. And I couldn't shoot myself because at this point, I was suspended from my job. I no longer had access to my weapon. So I walked over to the window, and I opened up the window. I was going to jump out. I opened up the window, I was on the 5th floor of the hotel, and I remembered I was scared of heights, you know. I made 23 jumps, and I'm sure I didn't feel scared of heights, you know, I never overcame my fear of heights. So I couldn't do that, so I went in the bathroom, and I filled the bathtub up with water, and I had a blow dryer, and I was going to pull the blow dryer in the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I would put the blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I was about a foot and a half short on cord. So I got one foot in the tub, and I'm leaning and trying to plug in. And it's like a scene out of that Woody Allen movie where he couldn't even kill himself. I was, it's okay to live, but I never ever wanted to get the pain I was in that day. So the only tool that I had left was my car. So I took one last spin through the neighborhood, and I started up on the Falls Bridge, and I come down the East River Drive, and that's a winding road along the Schuylkill River. And thank God I picked this day of all day. I now know my higher power is looking out after me, but back then I didn't do it. It's like a Wednesday or Thursday morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, rush hour's over. And it's an extremely winding road, and I come flying down it, you know, and I decided I was going to end my life in an automobile accident. And it wouldn't take much for me to go to oncoming traffic because there was no barriers. You know, it's like a two-lane road and traffic in each direction. So something hit me, you know. Emotionally, something hit me, and I just started crying, and I realized I didn't want to go to oncoming traffic because I didn't want to hurt anybody else. And by this point, like I said, I hurt everyone I came in contact with, everyone, especially those closest to me, my family, my loved ones. I hurt them the most. So I really didn't want to go to oncoming traffic. So I decided I would wrap myself around a tree. Now I'm flying down the road, and I'm cooped, and I'm crying, and I'm just losing, I'm speeding, I'm just nuts. And I now know my higher power is looking out after me. And I finally pulled over at the end of New Shore Drive, Boathouse Road, and I pulled over and I sat behind the wheel of my car, and I cried like a baby for about 5-10 minutes. And I reached into my wallet, and there was that ad that I cooked Ellie Daly News about 6 weeks before. And I walked over to the phone. It's no longer there, but one of those glass and closed phone booths outside the last boathouse. And I went in and I dialed this phone number up. And I spoke to the woman who answered the phone. I spoke to this woman like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. I figured she didn't know me from a can of paint. I could always hang up, you know. But once I started, I couldn't stop. And I just poured my whole story out to her, what was going on in my life, the shambles and everything else. And she listened patiently, God bless her. And when I got done, she says, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital and somebody be waiting for you? I said, okay. So I drove over to the hospital, and there was someone waiting for me, and they admitted me to their test for it, a psychiatric unit. And I spent about 3 or 4 days there until I got me stabilized. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia, and I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coastville, and after spending a number of weeks in their flight deck, they finally put me into an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and called that phone number, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I did not think that I had a problem with alcohol. I thought it was my short use of other substances. Maybe I got this stress stuff they're now talking about. I got this from the service. I got this from my job. Maybe I got this mental illness and I inherited this from my mother. You know, maybe it's the neighborhood I'm living in, the fact that I'm a mama. You know, it's all this other stuff. It can't be booze. I'm a beer drinker, you know, and it's just nuts. So I got put in this alcohol and drug ward, you know. I'm there about 20 minutes. They got me in the day room, and they got these large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I go up, I zip through the steps. I got about 6 of them done. I saw the amends. I said, they're screwed. That don't apply to me. You know, that's on them. But I was nuts. And now I'm looking around the room, and these guys, you know, they're telling their stories. And now I'm starting looking for the differences and not the similarities. A lot of these guys like got locked up. I said, well, that never happened to me. And these guys were divorced. It never happened to me. Now I know if I was married, I'm sure I'd have been divorced. And if I wasn't a cop, I'm sure I would have got locked up. But I'm looking for the differences and not the similarities. But what happened later that night, two men came up and carried the message. And I would later find out that these men were part of the treatment facility committee. And they came up and carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I didn't like, couldn't identify with, didn't relate to, I would immediately tune him out. Too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. But what bothered me the most was at the end of the meeting, everyone got in a circle, held hands, and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what you people were about, then I don't want nothing to do with you. Because I hated God. And I know them strong words, but I did. I hated God. I remember I would pull cars over sometime, right? I'd come up, and I didn't do this that often because I wasn't like a high crime area. I didn't have time to pull cars over. Like, you really needed to do something crazy to catch my attention. And I would pull up, and I would see these little bumper stickers on these cars as I'm walking up. And it would say, like, live and let live, one day at a time. And I said, I got one of these Jesus freaks. They're gonna, you know, and I'd go up, and they'd give me some story about some sort of meeting or something. I'd be giving them the ticket. Here you go, anyway, get the hell out of here. And I'd later come in AA, and I see all these slogans up on the wall. Now I'm curious, why the hell everyone in AA is speeding? Now I know what they're talking about. But what bothered me the most when they said this prayer, you know, I don't want nothing to do with you people. I talk about my mom's illness. My mom was like a fundamentalist, you know. And there was pictures and candles and, you know, radio programs and everything else throughout the house. I was 15. I came home from school. I'm in my house about 10, 15 minutes. And just something's just not right. I don't know what it is. And I go, you know, walking around the house, and I finally came across my mother. She had slit her wrist. And I remember she looked up at me. She said, "Bobby, help me." And I looked down at her and said, "Good for you." And I walked out of the house. And I got an older guy to go to the state store and get me a quart of wine. And I stayed out and I drank the wine. I stayed up most of that evening. And I came home later that night, and my father had told me what happened. And I acted surprised. I said, "Oh, yeah, how about that?" So that happened when I was 15. I wouldn't get sober till I was 27. So that's 12 years of hating God, and it would be a couple more years before I would deal with this. So I don't want nothing to do with God. So I broke away from the group and went and said a prayer. When I got done, when it came time for me to get out of the VA hospital, a nurse just took a liking to me. God bless. I don't know why. You know, it must have been an Al-Anon. And I don't mean that facetiously, because she saw right through my crap, and she came up to me. She said, "You know what, man?" She said, "The only way you're really going to make it, you're going to need to go to AA meetings." And I went to AA meetings every single day. And I need to tell you, that's the best piece of advice I got. The VA hospital helped me out tremendously. But I would get my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had some other things they helped me with. But the best piece of advice they gave me was to go to AA meetings. I went to AA meetings every single day. I don't drink coffee, so I don't make it. I don't smoke cigarettes, so I don't empty any more ashtrays. I would get to a meeting late. I would leave early. I'd go to a big book meeting or step meeting. That was strictly by accident. I had something more important to do. I would leave at the break. I had something more pressing to do. I walk into a tradition meeting. I said, "What the hell is this? Rules. My line of work, we're not good with rules. We love and force them, but they're for other people. They ain't for us, you know. So I'm not interested in the traditions either. I'm interested in war stories." And again, the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I couldn't like, didn't relate to, or didn't identify with, I immediately tune him out. Too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. And all these guys were locked up and all this other stuff. And now I'm saying, "Oh, man, I ain't not like these guys. You know, I'm definitely better than." I'm sitting in this bar, sober 9 months, because they sell real good roast beef, right? And I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking seltzer out of a rock glass, you know? And guys from my, it was my neighborhood, you know? And guys from my neighborhood came in, and they started giving me a hard way to go, because I was arrogant. And, like, towards the end of my drinking, you know, I started getting a lot of negative publicity. And the truth is, the reason I was back, I wanted to let people know that I was back, you know? Things were cool, don't believe the hype, you know? I'm all right. So I'm drinking seltzer, you know, out of the rock glass. And they come in and they start breaking my stone back and forth. And I just had enough. I said, "How with this?" And I stood up and I had this rock glass. And I just punched this guy right in the face, man. And cut him with blood like a pig. Cut him, man, big scar down the side of his face. And the cops came in. The guys who handled the job, they knew me. And they cut me a break and they let me go. And that's where I learned my lessons about people, places, and things, you know. And I've since been in a place that sells real good roast beef without being in that type of environment. You know, I got no business being there. I was sober at just under a year, and all the men in the group were going on a retreat. And, you know, you got to be careful because they come up and they, like, trick new people. And, you know, and they caught me off guard. They came up to me, and they asked me if I was working that weekend. My response should have been, "Why?" But, you know, and I didn't want to say yes because I didn't want to miss out on something, but I said, "Why?" And they but I didn't. I said, "No, I wasn't working." They said, "Good." They said, "There's a retreat this weekend. We're taking you to it." And you know what? I really liked these guys, but man, I hated them. You know, I wanted to hang out with them, but I wouldn't talk to them. And I wanted to be accepted by these guys, but I avoided them. It was just nuts. So these guys saw through all that stuff, and they said, "We're going to take you on this retreat with us." I said, "All right." And all during this ride to the retreat, I got a knot in my stomach because, you know, they knew something's up. I'm not saying a prayer. And I can't tell these guys what happened to my mom, you know. And I couldn't tell them, but I wanted to be accepted by these guys. It's just like the dilemma. I get to the retreat. I'm there about 15 minutes, and I run into the retreat master. As soon as he saw me, his eyes lit up. He's my disciplinarian from high school. But not only that, but he's a longtime member of AA. He just smiled. He said, "Man, it's good to see you." He said, "That was your problem, huh?" So we start talking. And he wants to know how long I'm sober. I'm telling him. And he said, "That's great." He said, "You got a sponsor?" I said, "No, I don't need one." And I didn't tell him I didn't need one, but I'm a pretty bright guy, but I knew I didn't need one. But I just told him, "No." I said, "I don't have a sponsor." He said, "I strongly suggest you get a sponsor." I said, "Okay."
So I asked my roommate to be my sponsor just in case in the future, should I have ever been questioned, I now have an answer. And I would go to meetings. I would see this guy in meetings, and he would raise me and say, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, yeah, I'll give you a call. I never called him. Nobody used to. I would tell people stories. I said, oh, you won't believe this guy. He got me doing this. He got me doing that. You know, he didn't do any of that stuff. I made it up. He put the hand of hope out there, the hand of AA, and I'm the one who slapped it away and talked crap about this guy. You know, nuts. I was sober a year and a half, and just a little bit more. It was, back up. My one-year anniversary came, and I spoke. And I got done speaking. It was incredible. You know, thunderous applause, you know. The blind could see, the lame walked. It was incredible. And I got done speaking, and people came up, and they patted me in the back, saying, way to go, Bobby, you're doing so good. I felt like a creep. I lied during my entire story. I lied. I identified myself as an alcoholic because in my group, they didn't want to hear that other stuff. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I really thought it was my short use of other substances. I thought that was my problem. I got this stress disorder. I got that issue. I got this mental illness from mom. I got all this stuff happening. I'm a beer drinker. I only said I was an alcoholic because that's what you guys want to hear. In fact, during the course of my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. But you guys don't want to hear that. You want to hear all the quotes and the literature, and that's what I gave you. And when it came up and they patted him in the back and said, man, you're doing so good, I felt like a creep. I felt dying inside. Because I wanted to ask these guys for help, but I couldn't, you know? And I knew they would have been there for me. They were. But I just, it was just nuts. I was 23 months sober. I beat another man at a baseball bat. And I forget what step I was working that day. But I was crazy. I was nuts. I made meetings every single day in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was dying from untreated alcoholism. Just like Patty said this morning, I did everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing I didn't do, I didn't pick up a drink. I would come and share these witty stories from the floor, right? And people say, that's all right, just don't drink. I took that and meant I could do whatever the hell I want to do, just don't drink. And I now know that's not the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. My early recovery, like my first couple years, I used to go to like a lot of go-go bars, but I drank soda, right? And I would get like my picture taken, and I would come to meetings and pass these pictures around to the old-timers because I thought they would like that, because I really wanted to be liked by these guys. They would look at the picture, and they would look at me, and they would just shake their head. And they would say, please, keep coming back. And I thought they were being facetious. I said, all right, I'll keep coming back. I was nuts. No one asked me to be their sponsor. No one wanted what the hell I had. You know, I carried the disease. I didn't carry the message. Second anniversary came. I didn't celebrate it. I was crazy as a bedbug. I swear to God, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I was wondering why everybody was blowing this guy's anonymity. I'm saying, you know what? He's really tough, SOB. I don't want to tangle with this dude. When I found out who John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid, as I should have been. But here I was so damn bright, it damn near killed me. Another true story. In my group, you know, we have anniversaries for the month. You know, we have a court board. So here it is. It's January, and I'll have your first name, last initial. Like, Joey A, 3 years, Bobby C, 2 years, and down the list, right? I used to take pleasure, like Joey A had 3 years, and I had 2 years, and Joey went out. I used to take pleasure in that. I'm not proud. I thought, like, I believed in the seniority. I thought, well, he's out. I got 2 years. I'm up. He's gone. That's nuts. I swear to God, I hated everyone. But you know who I hated the most? I hated the new guys who were getting better before me, because how dare they? Because I'm caught up on this time, you know? I got 2 years, this guy got a year, he's got this glow about him, and, you know, he's doing all right. I hated him. I said, Christ, where's mine at? The reason I didn't have mine, I wasn't taking any action. Dying from untreated alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a liar, thief, and cheat. I 13-step people. I did everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I made meetings every single day, and depending what shift I was working, I'd make two or three meetings a day. Dying from untreated alcoholism. Second anniversary came and went. Didn't celebrate it. A month afterwards, 25 months without a drink, I wanted to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before, I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Wanted to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life is unmanageable. I was clueless. I really didn't want to drink. I knew that was an option. I didn't want to drink. And I really didn't want to shoot myself either. I wanted what these guys had, but I was scared of these guys. Guys doing the right thing intimidated me. I never had the courage to do the right thing. I hid behind the badge. I hid behind the bottle. I never had the courage to do the right thing. I saw this guy from my neighborhood. His nickname was Troubles. There's a hard-earned nickname. But no one called him Troubles, at least not to his face, because he didn't like it. But he was in and out of jail in the 60s and 70s, you know. And I saw this guy, and he was sober for a number of years in AA. And it just wasn't in the rooms of AA, but it was in the neighborhood. And I knew that he was for real, you know. And one day I'm at a meeting, and I saw him, and after the meeting I went up to him, and I said, Bobby, I said, I need some help. I said, would you be my sponsor? He looked at me, he said, Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple of years. And I said, oh, he likes me, you know. He said, I need to tell you. He said, you're full of shit. And I couldn't believe he said that, because that's not like the response I'm looking for. He said, I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. A, you're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to one big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a set meeting. You're going to go to a men's meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment, and you're going to leave them damn women alone. And I'm saying to myself, like, who's he talking to? I got 25 months sober. I'm selling the grapevines. I mean, what's going on here? You know? But what I did do, I looked him dead in the eye. I said, okay, I'm willing to do that. And that's the night that I took the first three steps. Like I said, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. There's no question about that. But I wanted to eat my gun. My life was certainly unmanageable. You know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And that's the solution. That's the problem. And if powerlessness is the problem, then came to believe that a power greater than myself. The second step. And regardless of my resentment towards God, because I still had this resentment, and I was caught up on that. And my sponsor said, Bobby, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. You know, do you believe, or are you at least willing to believe that there's a power greater than yourself? And I knew there was. You know, regardless of my resentment towards the church, I knew that it was happening. You know why? Because the miracle, the proof was in these newer guys. I saw these guys come in crazy as bed bugs, and here they are. They had some sort of life. They were. I didn't see them myself. You know how we tend to see our, you know, character defects in others before we see in ourselves. The same thing with growth. We tend to see it in others before we see it in ourselves. And I saw these new guys getting better, so I knew that there was a higher power working. And then I went home with him, and then he showed me the third step prayer, and together we got on the knees and we said the third step prayer together. And then he turned to me, he said, Bobby, there's a difference between making a decision and making a commitment. And that's the night that I made a commitment to go on with the rest of the steps. And he said, the way we do a third step, he said, you pick up paper and pen and we do a fourth step. Now, I didn't want to do one of these, right? Because I'm going to meetings. And I hear people say, whoa, easy does it. You don't want to get well too soon, do you? Ain't that the craziest thing you ever heard? I mean, it's we're the only ones who think that way. I mean, you get yourself a little something right away. No, don't want to get well too soon. You're right. I haven't had bronchitis in a while. Let me get develop bronchitis. I like to have that. And then you get bronchitis, and you don't want to get well too soon. You're right. It's been a while since I had pneumonia. Let me get pneumonia before that. It's the only disease I know where we don't want to get well too soon. Yeah. So. Keep it simple. I mean, we kill people with slogans. And slogans are appropriate. They have its place. But I was taking it saying, well, you know, people are saying just don't drink and go to a meeting. I'm a pretty bright guy. I'm turning that around and saying, well, if I don't drink, why do I need to go to a meeting? How come I can't stay home and, like, watch Seinfeld and stay sober? You know, it's nuts. So, but I did my inventory, and you know what? That big boogeyman I thought it wasn't that, you know? And I later found out those who were telling me to keep it simple and, you know, slow down, and, you know, I realized they didn't do an inventory, because those who did an inventory encouraged me to do one as soon as possible. And I did it, and you know what those, you know, there were no secrets jumped out. Everything I wrote down, I did. You know, no surprises. The first step was kind of tough, though. You know, I wasn't going to talk to my sponsor about this stuff, so when I got done, you know, he called me up. I said, yeah. I said, you know what, Bobby, I've been thinking. I said, you know what, I'm going to do a retreat next weekend. And I'm going to go up on that retreat and do my first step with a priest. He said, that's great, Bobby. He said, when you get done, you stop by my house and you do it with me. And you know how sponsors could be on the phone. Like, I'm sending him something like, what's he, deaf? He didn't hear what I said. And he must have picked up my attitude. He said, Bobby, I heard you. He said, my job as your sponsor is to help you grow, take you through these steps. If I'm going to help you with your character defects, I think I need to know what these are. Now, the only reason I wanted to go with this priest, I need to tell you, even though I had God on my resentment list, it's still there. I didn't do this to any type of spiritual enlightenment or anything else. I was terrified that if I would tell Bobby some of these things, that he would ridicule me, he would pay judgment on me, or worse, he would take some of the things I told him and break my confidence. That's why I wanted to go with the priest and not with Bobby. And I later found out, you know, there were fears and my list wasn't done. I needed to go back. And I would later find out that they were all unfounded fears, because my sponsor didn't do any of those things. He didn't pass judgment on me. He didn't ridicule me. And he didn't tell anybody else. In fact, what he did, he shared some of his stuff with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness that I thought that I had, because believe it, I thought I was the only guy to do certain things or have certain thoughts. And when he shared himself with me, it took away that uniqueness, and I'll be forever in his debt for doing that, you know. And I didn't burn my fourth step, you know. I know there's a lot of fires happening out there, but I know I needed it for the rest of the steps, you know. He made me sit quietly for that hour, and I go to a lot of step meetings, and sometimes I don't hear people talk enough about that. And I guess he wanted me to do it at his house, because when I came over, he said, Bobby, we need several hours. But he already had that hour built in, and he made me sit there, and he had like a little quiet room in his house. And, you know, I just bought a house during the summer, and I created a quiet room myself with the guys that I sponsor. And I sat quietly. And you know what? My experience may be different from yours, but I can only talk about mine, right? The screaming inside stopped. And that may not sound a lot, but at this point, I'm sober, I don't know, maybe 29, 30 months. My head stopped racing, and that was incredible, man. I just felt at ease, you know. There were still things I needed to deal with, but for me, for the screaming inside stopped, man, that was incredible. So, and because I didn't burn my fourth step, you know, I knew what my character defects were. And I never knew what these were. I would go to meetings, I hear people talk about these character defects, and I don't know what the hell they was talking about, you know. I knew that I was a character when I drank, but I now knew that I had no character whatsoever by doing an inventory. And so, you know, I became willing. And then I asked God to remove those defects. And my sponsor told me, he said, Bobby, it's much more than a prayer. You know, I could pray all day long. God, help me be patient. Help me be patient. And if I'm put in a position and I'm not patient, that prayer goes out the window. He said, this is a program of action. You know, God will do for you what you can't do for yourself. But you need to do some work here, you know. The eighth step, you know, because I didn't burn my fourth step, most of my eighth step was done. I just added more names. And I was one of these guys, I didn't harm anybody but myself. That should have been a tip-off. I never did an inventory because I harmed everybody, you know, especially those closest to me the most. And the eighth step, I just needed to put more names in it. I had to become willing. And if I didn't have the willingness, I can pray for the willingness, you know. The ninth step, direct amend. No phone calls, no letters from me, because you know what? I didn't beat you with a bat over the phone or rob you through the mail, you know. And when I want to do those measures, I can give you any number of reasons why they live far away and all that other stuff. The truth is, I'm afraid. I'm afraid of the type of reaction I get. My sponsor said, direct amends, Bobby. No letters. No, that would say indirect. Let's read the word, direct amends. And I'd like to share two experiences on the ninth step. I'm at a meeting about 10 years ago, and I've seen this guy, and I have not seen this guy since 1977. And he was not on my eighth step list, not through any fear or nothing, but, you know, just out of sight, out of mind. But as soon as I saw this guy, I recognized him. Now, I'm at this meeting, and it's the first time I've been at this group. And they introduce me. And I stand up, and I say, my name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. And I need to tell you why I use my full name, you know. I know a lot of those traditions are misunderstood, but this one's definitely a biggie, you know. All of a sudden, we become sober, and we're like, we join the mafia, right? We get all these nicknames. There's Red Sweater Jerry and Frank the Fox and Bucktooth Mary. And I don't want no one to know that I'm in AA. Everyone in my neighborhood knew I was a drunk. It was those little telltale signs, you know. They come outside, they catch me urinating on their car. My girlfriend threw all my clothes out the window. I'm slumped behind the wheel of my car. I'm running down the neighborhood, coked out of my mind. Like, everyone knows that I'm a drunk. God forbid I get sober, I'm worried about my reputation. The 11th tradition is real clear. It says, at the level of press, radio, and film, you will not see my full name and my picture in the newspaper, on the television, or on the radio saying, my name is Bobby Coolio, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the violation of the 11th tradition. But this is not a secret society. In fact, Dr. Bob said, when one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that is a violation of the 11th tradition. God forbid you feel like drinking 3 o'clock in the morning. What are you going to do? Call information? I'd like to have Bucktooth Mary's phone number. Or you want to go visit one of these old-timers, right? And you're going, yeah, what room Frank the Fox in? If they got a strike word, they're going to make it, you know? It's not a secret society. However, I have no right whatsoever to break anybody else's anonymity. Just because I've been very involved in service in my area, Area 59, we use our full name, and that's why I use my full name. You know, but I have no right to break anybody else's anonymity. So let me get off that soapbox. So I see this guy. I look him dead in the eyes. And my name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, we sober up. We clean up. He didn't recognize me until I said my name. And as soon as I said my name, he nodded his head. And when I got done speaking, I turned to him. His name was Bob also. No, I didn't break his anonymity. It's Bob. His name, not Bob also. His name was Bob. And so I looked, and I told the group what I used to do. I was in a bar one day, and then we exchanged words. And, like, I knew I took his heart, you know. And from that point on, I would, like, publicly humiliate that guy to make myself look like a tough guy. And I'm not a tough guy. I never was. But I would, like, with the verbal taunts, I would slap him. I knew he wouldn't do nothing. And one day I even spit on him. I mean, what worse thing can you do to a human being? Spit on him, you know? And so what I did, I looked him dead in the eye and I told the group what I did. I said, Bob, I said, I'm truly sorry for what I did. But my sponsor told me making amends is much more than saying I'm sorry. There are two words for me that don't mean squat. It's about righting a wrong. And I looked him dead in the eye and said, I'm truly sorry. And I said, as long as I'm sober, I hope I don't treat you or any other human being that way. You know what? He came up and he hugged me. And man, it was an incredible experience. So after the meeting, we're talking, you know? And I need to tell you, I said, Bob, what brings you here? Because I live in South Philadelphia. He lives in Northwest Philadelphia. This meeting was in North Philadelphia. And I said, Bob, what brings you here? He said, Bob, yeah, I was flipping through the meeting list today, and I was just looking for a different meeting, and this meeting jumped out at me. And I need to tell you, we had 1,600 meetings a week in Philadelphia. Our meeting list was like 60 pages long. And he flipped through it, and he said, you know, this meeting just jumped out at me. I'm a firm believer that God put that guy in my path that night. It says wherever possible, not whenever, because for us, whenever denotes time, and for us, it ain't never the right time because we're too busy easy, doesn't it? You know, wherever possible, that guy was right there, and I had two options. I can acknowledge him and make the amends, or I could do what I used to do, pretend I didn't know you. Like, people come up before and confront me on my stuff, and they say, yo, I say, whoa, you got me confused. You're talking about my brother. Because, you know, there was nine of us, and my mom was pregnant for 10 years. Like, we're all, like 11 or 10. Like, I got a sister who's 11 months older than me, and my brother was, like, 11 months younger than me. So, like, there's 10 of us, nine of us, like, in a 10-year span. So there's a close resemblance. So people come up and, oh, you got me confused. You want my brother Frankie, not me. But what I did, I chose to make amends, and that guy hugged me, and he forgave me, and that was an incredible experience. And on the flip side, on the ninth step, I'm at a business meeting one day. My home group was the Stepping Stones group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made a motion, and it was definitely for the betterment of AA. I'm sure it was, because I made it. And, you know, my boy Freddie was there, and Freddie opposed me. And I couldn't believe it, because in my neighborhood, I mean, there's certain, like, things you do. Like, there's rules you live by. And one of the things, you always back your boy. Right, wrong, or indifferent, you always back him up. That's what, it's just, like, the rule. And he didn't go along with it. And I couldn't believe it. I said, man, how dare you? I would go to the meeting. I would see him, you know, numerous times. I would never speak to him again. There'd be four men sitting at the table. I would come in and say hi to three of them and completely ignore Freddie. I remember one day I was at work, and one of my coworkers came up to me. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels is outside. He wants to take care of some sort of business. I peeked out the window. I said, tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall. He needs to go down there. He came through that here. And a few weeks after that same coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, I just want to let you know that Freddie Wheels died last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. Now, here he was, a friend of mine, and as God is my judge, I can't tell you what that motion was about. He was put in my path numerous times, and I had an opportunity to make amends, and I chose not to, you know? And as soon as you said he always spoke so highly of you, I felt like a creep. You know, and I've been praying for Freddie ever since, you know. So there's two examples of the ninth step. And for those who've done ninth step work, you know, it's a credible feeling when you do it, you know. And it's kind of painful when you don't do it, you know. For me, the tenth step is nothing but 4 through 9 on a regular basis. You know, you can't continue to do something if you've never done it before. Now, if I'm going to stand up here and tell you I do a tenth step every day, I'd be lying to you. But I'm pretty consistent. You know, I'm pretty good with it. And I used to say, well, if I don't do it, no one knows it but me. That's not true. Because when I don't do a 10th step, my character defects come out, I become a nitwit, and you're affected by it. Especially should you cross my path that day when I'm in nitwit mode. I affect everybody, you know. My family, everyone's affected. And you know what? When I'm on the beam, when I'm doing the right things, people around me, that's contagious too, you know. You know the old saying, you can't miss what you never had? Well, in early recovery, when I was at those meetings, when they were going nice and calm and serene, I would get my hand up to get it goofy. Because serene people scared the hell out of me. So I needed to get the meeting going crazy.
and that I was comfortable with craziness. I love that. But now I don't like craziness. And when I'm off the beam, I now know what I need to do to get back on the beam. And for me, that's the 10th step, you know. The 11th step, do prayer and meditation. I do pray and meditate on a regular basis. And I've definitely improved my conscious contact with God, you know. And it may not be the way that I was raised as a kid. And again, just like Patty said, you know, the church is no longer my problem, you know. I used to blame the church. You know, I used to blame the Air Force. I used to blame the police department. I used to blame my neighborhood. I used to blame my mom. My mom wasn't the problem. My mom was just a sick woman. And none of those other things was the problem. I found that out through the steps. The problem was me, Bobby Coyle. And I was the problem long before I picked up a drink, all through my drink. And I definitely was the problem. And I put the drink down, I still was the problem, you know. I found that through the steps. Now, the steps, not only did they relieve the obsession to drink, but they helped me out a lot of other ways. You know, that thing, you know, my background, and again, with my mom, you know, I was sober a number of years. So I sat down with my dad, and I told my dad what happened. You know, what? And my dad forgave me, you know. And there's a lot of things about my past that I'm not proud of, and I would change in a heartbeat, but I can't. But you know what I got as a result of doing the steps? It changes my attitude about my past, and my past is no longer coming back and biting me in the ass. I'm now allowed to share that and share my experience with other people. The 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I've had that awakening, you know. No burning bushes, no lightning bolts, no voices from above. In fact, it's been a number of years since I heard any voices at all. It's great. We try to carry this message, you know. Sometimes my sponsor got to remind me about that word try, you know. I get done, I want to quote the book, and when I get done, I want to backhand you with it just to make sure that it's okay, you know. We tried to carry this message. But that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, having had a spiritual awakening. I've been to thousands of meetings since I've been sober, and I hear some crazy things. I got to look up the slogans to make sure I'm in an AA meeting, you know. I now know when I 12-step somebody that I need to mention the spiritual aspect of the program. If not, I'm lying to them. Because left to my own devices, I'm a liar, a thief, and a cheat, you know. That's the type, I'm irresponsible, you know. All those things. I need to talk about the higher power. People say, don't talk about God to newcomers because you're going to scare them. Well, if they're lucky, alcohol chased their backside right back here because they got nowhere else to go. So I'm going to compromise the message of Alcoholics Anonymous so I don't want to offend anybody. I can't do that, you know. And so I speak freely that the spiritual aspect. You know, spiritual, not religious. But the most important thing about that 12 step, that last part, is practice these principles in all my affairs. I'm only in an AA meeting an hour and a half a day. What about the other 22 and a half hours? What about the time of my job, the time in my neighborhood where it's tough to stay sober? I live in one of the neighborhoods, like strange phenomenon. Like, we have a lot of things that tend to fall off the back of trucks. It's just one of the neighborhoods. And, you know, and all types of other things happen. It's just one of the neighborhoods, you know. And it's tough for me to stay sober. It's easy in an AA meeting, but in the neighborhood, I need to, you know, practice your principles all my affairs. Patty said it today. I remember going to work. I'm coming down 995. It runs right up down the coast. I'm flying down 95 going to work, and someone cut me out. You know, I think sometimes 95. I used to tell people when I pull them over, I said, that's the name of the highway. It's not the speed limit. But I would, you know, people would cut me out, and I can't give them the finger and chase them 5 miles. That wouldn't be practicing these principles all my affairs. And when this meeting comes over, and then they come up and they thank me, and someone drops their wallet, and I do one of these numbers with my foot, and I put that wallet in my pocket, that wouldn't be practicing these principles in all my affairs, you know. I need to do that, you know, for me. Not only for me, but for other people. 12-step work comes a lot of different fashions, you know. And that's what the preamble says. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. If I'm only staying sober and not helping the other alcoholic, that's half measures, and half measures avail us nothing. It says you've got to give it away in order to keep it. But you can't give away what you don't have. And 12-step work comes a lot of different ways, you know. There's some of us, I was very involved in the area, you know, and I tell you, in 1994, I was the ultimate delegate for my area. I wanted to be the youngest delegate ever to the General Service Conference from Area 59. Didn't happen. 1994, I got diagnosed with cancer. And it was a real fluke way, the way I found out. So I went and got a second opinion, and it got confirmed. Lung cancer. I never smoked in my life. Smoked pot for a little bit, but I never smoked a cigarette in my life. I couldn't believe it. And I don't want you to think I handled this well, because I didn't. I had a very tough time. I said, I'm sober for a while. I'm doing the right thing. And, like, you know, my life is happening. And my sponsor, God bless them, you know, they're great. They cut right through the chase there. And they said, Bobby, what the hell are you going to do about it? I said, okay. Now, when I got the second opinion, the very first thought said, Bobby, you can smoke reefer because people in chemotherapy smoke pot. I didn't smoke any pot because I've seen some terrible men, I saw some men and women go through some terrible things through their own without picking up a drink or drug. And I got through that, you know, and I learned that by going to AA meetings, you know. So I went through treatment and, you know, I went in remission and I got sick again. And I needed to give up the position I had because I wasn't doing the area any good. I was just wiped out, you know. And I got very sick. And, you know, and things weren't looking good there for a while. And I finally got released and I got home and I was always made meetings. Always. I was always a meeting maker. And I couldn't make meetings for quite some time. I was laid up. And people start coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now you're looking at a liar, thief, and a cheat. I took from everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And I'm talking to people I really didn't even know that well. I mean, my friends came, but people I just met like through area assemblies. Was coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm a firm believer that the doctors did a pretty good job, but the prayers in AA, man, was incredible. I'll tell you the one thing about getting news like that, getting sick. It helps you finish up that ninth step, just in case you delayed, because I thought the scales are still like this, you know. But it was incredible, you know, it was an incredible experience, you know. I was in Mexico, and so I'm talking about 12-step work. So 12-step work takes a lot of different fashions, you know. You get involved in a lot of things, like this, putting on a conference. There's some of us who may have more time, you know, me being single, you get more time, you can get involved in the area, you can get involved in your central office. Some people get involved in prisons and institutions, you know, things like that. Some of us are work behind the scenes, you know, we could balance the checkbooks. And then there's some of us who should never, ever be nowhere allowed near a checkbook. But I'm a firm believer that everyone in this room has a gift. And you know what, you need, it may be different than the person sitting next to you, but you need to find out what your gift is. You got to give it away in order to keep it, because there were people there for us. And for us, you know, Bill Wilson said, it would be arrogant to think that AA would be around forever. He said, should it fall, it would fall from within. And when anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there. And for that, I'm responsible. I can't worry about what anybody else is doing. And that's why I make regular attendance at meetings. I'm there a good 5, 6, 7 times a week, you know. I make meetings because, you know what, the newcomer doesn't know that I live at 707 Sears Street. I go to meetings because that's where I find a newcomer. If a couple of my sponsees haven't talked to me for a while and I show up at a meeting and they're there and they want to talk to me, I says, nah, you got my number. There's a new guy over there. Let's talk to him. He don't have our numbers. Let's talk to him. You got to give it away in order to keep it. I'm in Mexico about 10 years ago. I thought I could speak Spanish. Those poor people probably still figuring out what the hell I said. My Spanish consisted of like, dame pistola, give me your gun, you know. So I'm going off in Spanish and they're looking at me wondering what the hell I said. So I switched over to English, and they still don't know what the hell I said. I was the only English-speaking person in the meeting. And you know what? When the meeting was over, they came up and they hugged me. And I can tell who the old-timer was by the serenity in their face, and I could tell who the newcomer was by the pain in their face. Language of the heart. They may not have understood the words, but they understood, you know? I love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I promise I want to finish real soon. You know, not 18 more stories. I'll be done real soon. I love AA. One of my favorite sayings in the big book, it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. If the newcomer can see no joy in our existence, they won't want nothing to do with us. Now, obviously, I just paraphrase that last sentence, but you get the deal. So what the thing is, if you think, especially if you're new, that you're here and you got to wear the hair shirt and beat yourself, man, you're greatly mistaken. Whatever you did drunk, you could do stone cold sober. You could be better at it. You could have more fun. And most of all, you can remember it. It's a bliss. I usually say this for the last, I'm a lifelong mummer, you know, and it's hard to describe, but you people from New Orleans should get the hang of this a little bit. It's a parade in Philadelphia. We do on New Year's Day, January 1st. It's been going on for about 250 years. It gets so nuts 101 years ago that the city finally organized it because it's nuts. But what it is, it's a bunch of men in sequins, feathers, and we get in the middle of the street and we dance. It's a blast. Now I've done a fifth step, so I'm free. I'd let you know what's going on. But know what it is, it's taken, there's some history behind it. The Greek god of ridicule was Mummers, and that's where Mummers is derived from. But it's a blast. Now we have brigades, and I know like the New Orleans, they have crews, right? So, but we have brigades, and it's the same setup. In fact, I usually tell people, not do I want to insult anyone from New Orleans, but I'm telling you, the Mummers Parade sometimes make Mardi Gras look like a Mormon convention. I'm telling you. It's really a cross between the Mardi Gras and the Full Monty. It's a bliss. It really is. Now, I'm a lifelong mummer. Now, when I got sober, I had to stop. You couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do it. So I'm in a meeting, and a kid came up to me and said, listen, you would be interested in watching the parade this year. I said, you're out of your mind. People poison things. I can't do that. He said, you don't understand. He said, we got a group. We got sober mummers. That's an oxymoron. I said, all right, I'll do it. And for this past 2 weeks ago, it was my 11th year up with the 12 Steppers, the 12 Steppers New Year's Brigade. It's a blast. Now, this past year was my... Oh, it's a blast. Now, it was also my 34th parade. What I was able to do, just because I got sober, I had to stay away from the parade, but here I am with recovering people doing something that's a big part of my family, but I can do it without the insanity of alcohol. So, man, it's just a great way of life. And I promise I'll finish up with this. I was, everything changed about 4 months ago, huh? I was back in August. I go up to New York fairly often. It's about an hour and a half ride from my house to Manhattan. I go up the General Service Office has a meeting every Friday morning at 11 o'clock, and then they do a tour. So if you're ever in the area, go by. It's a great experience. And back in August, I had a friend of mine call me up. He said, Bobby, he said, I had the chair for next month, September. He said, I have a couple nights open. He said, if we'd like you to come up. I said, what do you got? He said, well, I got the 4th and the 11th. I said, I'll tell you what, I said, come up on the 4th because I'm on the vacation. I was going to be out in San Francisco. I came back to Philadelphia on the 3rd, which was Labor Day. I said, come up to the 4th. He said, all right. So I went up, hung out with him. We had dinner, hung out, did the meeting, came home. And, the following Tuesday was the 11th. Obviously that meeting didn't take place because that meeting was no longer there. It was a couple blocks away from, it was destroyed. And my job, we got sent up. I now do critical incident stress management. We do debriefings, and like each major city has one. They got like a search and rescue team. They got these guys, debriefers. And so each major city has one, but because of the sheer magnitude of what happened up in New York, they had to call teams from up and down the coast. So we went up on the 13th, and I wound up spending a week up there, and it was a really incredible experience. And usually when I see something happen, like I know Florida a few years ago with the hurricane and North Dakota a couple years ago with the flood, I'm always amazed what happens to Alcoholics Anonymous, the office was closed for a couple of days, but then calls from all over New York was calling for the groups that were displaced, offering places to meet. And when I was up there that Saturday, I was very friendly with the fire chaplain who passed away. Father Mike, I went to many conferences with him, many retreats with him. And, I couldn't get into church. All the dignitaries were there, but the street people were hanging outside. And I must have run into about a dozen people from the program. And they asked me what I was doing. I said I was up here working. And, it was just an incredible experience. It was just whatever was going on, even though certain groups and my friend who invited me, they never found him. He worked in the towers, but we lost a lot of people up there. But AA went on. A couple meetings were displaced for some time, but Alcoholics Anonymous went on. So regardless of what you got going on in your life, Alcoholics Anonymous goes on. And it's just not one thing. It's the whole deal, It's home group. Home groups are very important. Sponsorship. Get involved in the program. The fellowship alone will not keep you sober. The fellowship's important, but that alone is not enough. It's a program of action, And then once you get yours, then you need to pass it on to other people, I only share my experience, strength, and hope. I never give my opinion from the podium. I mean, that's what the hospitality room's for. Catch me here afterwards, and I'll tell you. I'll tell you what I think's wrong, but. But my job as a sober man in Alcoholics Anonymous is to be a sponsor, to help other men, because I became a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really believe I'm a man of dignity and honor today, and I wasn't that when I first came in, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, I really do, and I thank the committee for the privilege of participating in AA meeting. That's all I got. Thanks.